The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 11, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. So I want to thank you all for being Sesshin. This Sesshin, being here, being now, being this. So thank you. As I was trying to think of how Norm, one of our senior teachers, Norm Randolph, would put it, and it's there was something like, you know, Sesshin is a strange practice. You know, it's something that if you try putting it into words what it is you're doing, and I don't encourage you to do this. Honestly, don't encourage you to do this. It would just elude you. It's a strange thing. And yet, you know, as Cynthia was pointing out, it is, in her talk yesterday, this is an opportunity for us to settle into reality. There is a quietude that is a part of Sesshin that lets us get in touch with reality in a way that we struggle to do in our daily lives, where there's so much, as I think Steve puts it in the chapter I'll be looking at, jabbering. It's something like jabbering, blabbing or jabbering, but we know what it is, that constant that's going on all the time. And in Sesshin, you can start to see it showing up in places maybe you don't expect it to. Just when you think it's gone, it starts again. So Sesshin is a great practice, and it really is a great opportunity. It is our meditation practice, and it's the meditation practice where we get to do it for a while, where we get to sit with this for a while. So thank you all for being part of this. So today I'm going to talk about a chapter from Steve Hagen's book, Buddhism is Not What You Think. Those of you who've been at some recent sessions know that I've been going through chapters in this. I read it many years ago, and I just never reread it, not for any particular reason, I just never did. And this was an opportunity to kind of return to this book, and it's been really a rich and rewarding return. So I just wanted to share this with people. The chapter that I want to talk about is called The Host Within the Host, which is a strange title, because you may not even know what that is referring to in any way whatsoever. So the host that Steve is referring to in this title is one who, you know, entertains guests, let me put it that way, just at a surface level. Now, there is a history of host and guest used as a metaphor to help us understand practice and understanding reality. And I thought I would just kind of look and see if I could find an earlier example of it to kind of help us situate what this chapter is going to be about. And I found a sutra that I'd never heard of before. Not that that's news. There are a lot of sutras, so that I haven't heard of one is not a surprise. But it actually kind of breaks down what guest and host are from the perspective of Buddha and the first student of the Buddha to have been enlightened. So it's an interesting conversation. The sutra is the Shurangama Sutra, and it's not often translated into English. I will say they can't find a Sanskrit copy of the sutra. They just have the Chinese translations of it. And sometimes that means it's really a Chinese text that's pretending to be an Indian text. But scholars don't believe that this one is apocryphal. They honestly just think they can't locate the Sanskrit text. I don't know why they think that, but that's their sense. And it's, you know, I don't know that it's translated much into English, but in Chan, which is, you know, Zen, Chinese Zen, this was an important sutra. So again, I'm just going to read you a few excerpts that help us understand this guest and host metaphor. So we have the Buddha, and he says, after my awakening, I went to Deer Park, where I said that beings in their multitudes have not become arhats, nor have they become fully awake, because they are confused by afflictions that are like visitors and like dust. What in particular at that time caused the five of you to awaken and become sages. So he's talking to his original students, the five students. What is it that caused you to awaken and become sages at this time when I gave this talk? And his student, Ajnata Kaundinya, that's a big mouthful, so I'm just going to call this student Ajnata from now on, Ajnata Kaundinya, who is Buddha's first student, just traditionally seen as Buddha's first student and seen as first Buddha's first student to awaken, answers. Now that name, Ajnata Kaundinya, has meanings to it, the Ajnata part. In this translation of the sutra, it said that Ajnata means one who understands, but I saw in another source a translation that also said it means first to awaken, knowledge of nothingness, or understanding of the origin. That is this person who's speaking to Buddha now. And that other part, Kaundinya, is just Kaundinya's family name. So it was a family name from India at that time. Ajnata says he was given his name Ajnata because I had come to realize what visitor and dust signify. It was in this way that I became a sage. World-honored one, suppose a visitor stops at an inn for a night or for a meal. Once his stay is ended or the meal is finished, he packs his bags and goes on his way. He's not at leisure to remain. But if he were the innkeeper, he would not leave. By considering this example of the visitor, the one who comes and goes, and the innkeeper, the one who remains, I understood what the visitor signifies. He represents transience. So we have these two dimensions to reality that are showing up in the host or the innkeeper and the visitor or the guest. So the guest is that transient world that comes and goes, that seems to show up and seems to go. This is an aspect of reality we know only too well. Stuff comes up. We're sitting here in Sesshin. Again, you think that stuff's gone, comes back again. You know, things seem to come, they seem to go. But then there is that aspect that just remains. That's, we say, always here. And that is just always here. And that too can be tasted, especially in Sesshin, but in our daily lives. This is sort of the root, the foundation of life. So Ajnata goes on to talk about dust, and I thought I would read that section too, because it just sort of elaborates on this distinction. It kind of adds one more wrinkle to it. When the sun has just come up, early on a... Oh, by the way, I thought the writing in this was nice too. So allow me to... Let me indulge in reading this one. When the sun has just come up, early on a clear, fresh morning, a morning after rain, the sun shines through a crack in the door, or perhaps a crack in the wall, and it displays the fine bits of dust bobbing up and down in space, moving all around in the sunshine. If the sun doesn't shine in the crack, you can't see the dust, although there is actually a lot of dust everywhere. But while the dust moves, bobbing up and down, space is still. It doesn't move. The ability to see the dust and the light that pours through the crack represents the attainment of the light of wisdom. When you reach the first stage of the Arhat and overcome the 88 kinds of deluded awareness, you have the light of wisdom. Then you can see your ignorance, which moves like the dust and sunlight and which causes so many afflictions as there are sand grains in the river Ganges. You will also see the unmoving stillness of your essential nature. So another way of looking at that, the dust moving in the light. But the added wrinkle to this is the light of wisdom that allows us to see this dust. This dust that's there, we know it's there. It's horrifying if you've ever stepped into your living room and then the light is shining just so you can see how much dust is floating around in your living room. But it was always there. It's not like the sunlight created it. Now we're aware of it. And it's a thing we didn't want to maybe believe was there. So there's the dust. The light of wisdom allows us to see the dust. This is very important, and this is what Steve's going to be talking about in this chapter. It allows us to see the dust. it allows us to be aware of the stillness of the space. So host is that stillness of the space. Host is that innkeeper that does not leave. And that's the host from the title. But what is the host within the host? We'll save that. It'll be suspenseful for you. Because that's what Steve actually gets to at the end of his piece. So I'm just going to read passages and then I'll stop and talk about the section that I've read. The essence of Zen is knowing freedom. Even though we think we're free, most of us are bound by our ideas, our beliefs, our concepts, our intellectualizations. As a result, we're imprisoned in a far more difficult and pernicious way than if we were behind steel bars. Yet no one imprisons us but ourselves. Often, people approach Zen in ways that only bind them all the more. We run to Zen with an urgent desire to be free and with a lot of notions about what freedom is. Then we implore the teacher to show us how to be free. All right, so Steve begins this passage. He says, the essence of Zen is knowing freedom. And if you are familiar with Steve's typographic idiosyncrasies, you know that that knowing is in italics. So this is not knowing the way that we usually think of knowing. And I'll refer to that kind of knowing with another word, understanding, which I think is a little bit more in line with the way maybe we normally think of knowing, is to intellectually understand something. But this knowing he's talking about is not that kind of knowing, right? He says the essence of Zen is knowing freedom, and that knowing is not wrapped up in intellection at all. It is actual realization of freedom. And that realization, again, realization, I like the word because it doesn't exclude an intellectual understanding, but it's not limited to it. That realization is actually something we realize, we fully embody, right, in our thought, in our speech, in our actions. That is the kind of knowing. It's knowing the freedom that we are, that we already are, that we lose sight of. So it's not, Steve doesn't say the essence of Zen, for example, is to possess freedom. And possessing freedom is perhaps a way that we commonly think of as something we do with freedom. Ah, that's something that I would like to have, possessing freedom. It's not understanding freedom. So that's that intellectual way of thinking. So we don't have to understand the freedom he's talking about. We have all kinds of ideas about freedom. That's not the freedom Steve's talking about. Whatever you think that freedom is, that's not what it is that Steve's talking about when he's talking about freedom. And it's not about believing. The essence of Zen is not about believing freedom. So if we are caught up in ideas of freedom, and we feel like we don't have that freedom, we at least can believe that we can be free. Or we could just have our ideas about freedom and believe them. So believe them that it seems like that's the truth of reality. So then he goes on to say, even though we might think we're free, most of us are bound. And to me that was really interesting. He goes, even though we might think we're free. That's the first thing he says. As he points out, he says, often people approach Zen in ways that only bind them all the more. They run to Zen with an urgent desire to be free. But if you think you're free, then why would you go to find that freedom? It's a very interesting conundrum that I was kind of thinking about as I looked at this paragraph. I'm not sure Steve meant it to be quite as convoluted as it seemed to me when I encountered it, but I just thought a little bit about that. And he says, even though we might think we're free, most of us are bound. And it's that very important think we're free, that we think we're free. And I thought, you know, if you start telling somebody they're not free, you just start telling somebody that, you're going to get some pushback. Odds are very likely that you will. If you've had the misfortune of talking about this practice in any way to somebody who doesn't know what you're talking about, and you did it without them inviting you to do it, you just started saying something, you'll see. because they'll get all kinds of ideas about what it is you're saying, and they push back very forcefully against it. And then you go, oops, why did I do that? And you just smile and you enjoy your tea with your friend, and that's what you do. So we do think that we're free. We have these ideas. Now, there's something about that thinking that we're free that I think we ought to pay attention to. Because I think that in that thinking that we're free is an expression of the fact that we actually realize we're free. That we know that we're free. Deep down in our bones, we know that we're free. We know it. But then we think about it. Then we have conceptualization. So we have this sense about the nature of this. And then we start to make sense of it. We conceptualize it. And in our conceptualizations, then we muck up our understanding. And we get caught up in our beliefs. And we start thinking that those conceptualizations, those intellections of freedom, are freedom itself. And we confuse those concepts with freedom. And then, and this is important, when those ideas no longer hold water, I can guarantee you right now that anything you believe, anything you think, anything about the way that reality is, you are going to bump up against its edges at some point. It will happen. It might be catastrophic, it might not be catastrophic, but you will bump up against the limits of the concepts you have of the world, especially if you believe them, especially if they're invisible beliefs, they're dust motes that do not have the light of the sun shining on them, you will, boom, come right up against it. And I don't know how you respond, but it'll be like, what was that? What was that? It's not supposed to happen that way. And again, this can happen to us on a daily basis, from the smallest thing to the biggest thing. Yeah, the biggest things don't happen necessarily on a daily basis, but those small things do. We encounter the limits of our beliefs continually. Then we sense something's not right, and we sense that we're bound somehow. We'll talk about that word bound perhaps a little bit later in the talk. But we get a sense that, oh, something's not right. And maybe that sense that I'm not, maybe not quite as free as I think I am. I really, you know, and we feel that constriction. And then what do? Then we come running to Zen. I don't know if we do come running to Zen, but you go running to something for help. Something's wrong. I need some help here. And so we go and we turn to a source that can help us, free us from the restriction, the constriction that we feel. And yet, with Zen, at least, Zen's going to do something that maybe some of us get frustrated with. There's a well-known story, actually, probably one that many of you have heard. If you've been at Dharma Field a while, you for sure have heard it, or if you've engaged in Zen in any way. Odds are you've heard it. It involves the third patriarch, Chinese patriarch, Sang San, and his student Dao Xin. And Dao Xin, like many of us, came to Sang San and said, please liberate me, free me, you know. And Sang San just said, well, who binds you? And Dao Xin said, take a look. And he said, well, no one binds me. And Sang San asked, then why do you seek liberation? And Dao Xin right there had insight. And that's an important question. So when we come to Zen, Zen says that. Who binds you? Not to give you an answer, but just to ask that question. Just to pose the question. I've been watching a television series called Reservation Dogs, a very funny show. And there's that spirit guide. Do you remember the spirit guide? And he says, I don't give answers. I just ask questions. I thought, that's great. This is absolutely right. Teacher just asks the questions. Who binds you? He doesn't tell him anything. He doesn't give him anything. Just ask him that question. So as Steve continues, he says, but the freedom Zen points to cannot be gained, earned, achieved, developed, or acquired. In fact, the freedom Zen points to cannot even be successfully sought. This is because freedom is already ours right from the very start. The only reason we don't realize this is we heap chains upon ourselves, and we do it in many varied ways. So that freedom, again, that Steve's talking about, the essence of Zen is knowing freedom. It's realizing freedom that's already here. But as I was pointing out before, first we have a sense that we're free, and then we get a sense we're not free, and then we want to be liberated so that we can be free, and so we go out looking for somebody to liberate us. And Zen teachers are going to say, well, who's binding you, right? The reason that Zen teachers do that is because there isn't this freedom for us to get or to have. As Steve says, this freedom cannot be gained, earned, achieved, developed, or acquired because it's already here. You can't acquire it. You can't get it. You can't achieve it. That's our usual way of thinking, and that is the way that when we come, you know, running to Zen, that we're caught up in, is this idea that, oh, there's something missing, and I need to get it. And that thing in this particular case might be freedom, whatever we mean by that. I need to go get that. That's just our usual way of doing things, but that is not what Zen is pointing to. That's not the freedom that Zen is pointing to. Again, that freedom is right here. It's very core, the very essence, the very nature of reality. So when I was thinking about that, I thought, what we can say on one hand is that we think we know what freedom is, but on the other hand, we actually know we're free. Now, there's something about conceptualization that Steve brings out here that I want to stress as well, because conceptualization often sounds like we're talking about ideas, about the work of thinking through something. And so then we think, okay, I just have to stop layering this idea that I have about the world. But these conceptualizations, they're like that. Step into a room, there's the conceptualizations and all that comes along with it. Right there. It's just right there. And conceptualizations aren't just intellectual. And this is what Steve's going to go into. Sometimes they show up for us as emotions too. And those, for some reason, feel more authentic or real, but they're still rooted in and are expressions of delusion. Steve says, it's not just intellectually that we bind ourselves, we do so emotionally as well. And then I was going to use this example that is really wonderful. The poet Basho beautifully expresses this kind of bondage in a haiku. Upon hearing a hototogisu, which is a kind of cuckoo bird that you hear in Japan. I gave a talk on this once, and I think, if I remember correctly, it was online. So I could use some AV equipment, and I played the song. I showed the picture of the hototogisu and played its song. In Japan, in Japanese poetry, hototogisu conveys a particular type of feeling, and it's this feeling that Steve is talking about. So upon hearing the hototogisu, a cuckoo-like bird known for its soft, nostalgic call, Basho wrote, I am in Kyoto, yet at the voice of the hototogisu, longing for Kyoto. God, I love that poem so much. And I've been there. And so has Steve. So he continues. He says, here's Basho in the beautiful city of Kyoto. He hears the call of the hototogisu. Suddenly, he feels a deep longing welling up from his heart. But he longs for Kyoto, the idea of Kyoto, even as he's in Kyoto. We all have such feelings at times. I've known such feelings lying awake in my tent at night in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, a beloved place I've returned to year after year for the better part of my life. When I hear the haunting call of a loon, there comes a deep longing in my heart for the Boundary Waters. Yet here I am in the Boundary Waters already. On the other hand, the suffering of Basho's and mine is very beautiful. It's a form of pleasure, yet it's still suffering. Still delusion. So if you see what Steve's pointing at, you know, the thing about that, the poem, the poem actually conjures the call of the hototogisu. I don't even know what it is, but I know what it is. Because I know what it is to be somewhere and long to be at the place that I'm at. And that emotion is so deep that we don't quite see that it too is rooted in conceptualization. So the particular emotion Steve's talking about is nostalgia, which is a very powerful one and has that bittersweet, that kind of pang to it that Steve's talking about. A little bit of pain in there, but there's beauty in it as well. And in that nostalgia, we have a sense that something that was is no longer, or that you wish you were back at some place that you are no longer. The etymology of the word is rooted in some Greek. The word nostos, which means return or home, and algos, which is pain. So it's returning home, that pain. And I would say, not just the pain in the desire to return home, but also the pain in actually returning home, right? It's homesickness. And, you know, to quote this sage from the Twin Cities, Dave Perner from Soul Asylum, right? He said once that he was homesick for this, for the home he never had. And I think that that's what homesickness is. That's what this feeling is there's a sense we have, a notion, a concept of, in this case, it's home, it's being at this place. And if we go to it, if we try to return to that place, it will always feel like it's not quite there. We'll always have that sense of longing. And that's the thing with homesickness, is you really can't quell it. The feeling I had, and I had both of these feelings, the sense of being in a place and being homesick for it, and then coming back to it, actually coming back to it, and then going, huh, things have changed. I've been out of town I moved to Milwaukee to go to graduate school, and when I came back, I was struggling with my dissertation, you know, and that puts you in a real sentimental mood when you go back to some place and you're in a place where you don't want to be anymore. And we were walking downtown, St. Anthony, Maine. If you know that area, it's very beautiful. We were walking across the Stone Arch Bridge. And even that conjured memories when I was in college, and that used to be fenced off. And it was like just an unused train track. And my friends and I would climb around the fence and just hang out on that bridge. You know, but it's a beautiful bridge, a beautiful view of the city. And I turned to my husband and I said, I want to move back here. I mean, it was very strong in me. And then we moved back and everything was different. I just went, oh, isn't the town I remember? It was really different. It wasn't necessarily bad, it was just different. So the thing that I was longing for when I got here wasn't really quite here. And then you sit and long for, the good old days. I don't know that I'm still there yet, but but it's easy to do. And nostalgia has that power to it. And what Steve says about nostalgia, too, the other thing that I think is really useful in this example, is that we might think of bondage, you know, in terms of like something that's onerous, something that's put on us, something that's binding us down. But here it's something that's pleasurable. And I would just ask, how often do you bind yourselves with pleasure, with that which is pleasurable to you? Harder to see when we're doing that. Much harder for us to see that. And I have just a quick example. That's one I've used often enough that I probably should stop using it now, especially because he's now 32 years old. But my nephew used to love the game Connect Four. And he'd play it on a video game. You know, there was a video version of it. And he would just play that game and play that game. And his parents were aware of the fact that he got too caught up in video games, so they would give him a certain amount of time he could play and such. And this was a long time ago. I remember his mom asking him, as he's playing Connect Four, which at that point it seemed like it was forever. And she said, Alex, have you gone to the bathroom? And he said, yes, Mom. And we didn't realize he meant in his pants, but that's what he'd done, because he was so addicted to playing that game, right, that he just was like, gonna stay right there, play that. And he was a kid. He was like 4 years old, 5 years old. So how often do we bind ourselves in our pleasure? And Steve goes on, he says, so how can we live lives that are free of delusion. So we have this delusion. Delusion is that which binds us, right? It's this conceptualization, this way we have of understanding the world. We take the phenomena that show up and we imbue it with a kind of truth that it never told us it had. And then we get confused. And that's delusion. So how can we live lives that are free of delusion? We can't. It's impossible. To the extent that we envision self and other, we necessarily live in a sea of delusion. We have a technical term for this in Zen. We call it muddy water. Now, I suppose you're all going, we have a technical term for it, and you're waiting for an eight-syllable Sanskrit word, but it's just muddy water. That's our technical term. But delusion isn't wrong or bad. Indeed, Zen is not about trying to get rid of delusion. Delusion doesn't go away. Muddy water is muddy water. If we try to get rid of it, we only stir it up all the more. Buddhas don't get rid of delusion. They just see it for what it is and are not taken in by it. We tend to think that we have to fight off delusion in order to live in enlightenment, or we imagine that if we can acquire enlightenment, we'll drive delusion away forever. This is all only more delusion. We don't acquire enlightenment. We already have it. Or more accurately, we're already in it. We're already of it. We can't be separated from it. All we have to do is see that this is so, and freedom is there. That's a great passage. So, yeah, the first thing he asks then is, so how can we live lives that are free of delusion? And he says, we can't. We can't. And what he means by that, well, he goes on, he says, to the extent that we envision self and other, we necessarily live in a sea of delusion. That's really difficult for us when our understanding of the world is that there's me and then there's a world and I'm moving around in the world or I'm not moving around in the world. Maybe I'm not moving around in the world because something the world did, or here I am and the world's doing this to me, or here I am and hey, the world's doing this to me, you know, whatever it is. That understanding of reality is delusion. Why is it delusion? We start to think about the guest and the host and the dust. And what we're doing is the stuff that's coming and going, the stuff that's showing up and going away, the stuff that appears and disappears. That's the stuff that is giving us the joy. That is actually, that stuff that's coming and going is our understanding of the world. It's stuff that's out there. And it's, you know, coming and going, sure, and that's going to create some problems for us, especially when it goes if we want it, especially if it comes when we don't want it. But that is the world of the transient, of what seems to come and what goes. And the host, the space, that which is still, we don't see that. We're so caught up in the stuff. We get so caught up in our ideas about what that stuff is. And it's very, very easy to do. I think only one of you was witness to my sock puppet presentation. But, you know, Steve had a stuffed monkey that he called George that he would bring out in a class, and he kind of manipulated it to help us to see how quickly we get caught up. And one of the last sessions, I made a little sock puppet, and I just kind of manipulated. It was just a sock. It actually didn't have any eyes or anything. It was just a sock. But you'd start to do that, and right there you go. You know, how quickly we get caught up in, it's not just the stuff. It's really what we think is going on. And it's not what we think is going on. It's just our sense of it. Boom. Right there. Whole. So we feel like we're missing freedom. Like, it's not here. I've got to get me some of that. That's built in to I, that sense that there's something I don't have. That's built into it. If there's an I, if there's me, little old me sitting right here, there's a whole bunch of stuff you don't have. And some of it you're probably grateful you don't have it, and other stuff you wish you had. But that's just built into that kind of understanding, is you're not going to have everything. You're going to have stuff out there you don't want and stuff that you wish you had and you don't have it right now. So that's delusion right there. We can't live a life that's free of delusion. We can't. If we're in the picture, then That's delusion. It's already showing up. But the other thing that Steve points out is that not only that, but this how do we live a life that's free of delusion? You need to be careful with that, because the other part of that is we want to be rid of it. We just want to be rid of delusion. We often think of delusion as being wrong or bad. And Zen teachings, Buddhist teachings, no, I'll never tell you that. That delusion is bad or delusion is wrong. It sounds like it. You go, well, delusion's binding me, isn't it? Well, what did Sengsan really say? Who's binding you? Yeah. Who's binding you? So that's the question. So delusion is not good or bad. It's not right or wrong. We're not trying to get rid of it. In fact, when we see freedom for what it is that freedom is helping us to see, we actually start to realize, remember what Steve had said, we realize that we're already of awareness. We're already of awakeness. You know, we're already that. We're already of freedom. So by saying that, not by saying that, but what that is that that's pointing to is the fact that there is not separation, that there are not these separate things. There also is pointing out the fact that whatever it is that's showing up is reality. Right? You can't be free of something. So thinking you can get rid of delusion is thinking that there are things out there you can get rid of. This thinking you can get rid of anything, which is a common way of seeing things. And then we can just ask ourselves, what is delusion anyhow? What are we talking about? What are we talking about? Because now we might be talking about some idea we have, because these words get brought up. What is it that we're talking about? And we think there's something there, but just what are you opposing if you're opposing delusion? What is it that you're opposing? What is this world? What are these things that are showing up? And these things are conceptual. They're emotional. They seem to have substance. They sure sound like they have it. Stub your toe against it, it'll feel like it does. But what is that? Remember, this is one of the chants that our chant leader recites after our meal. A very poignant verse. It was recited at my wedding, actually. In this world of emptiness, we know this, don't we? May we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Nothing surpasses the boundless mind. Thus we bow to Buddha. In this world of emptiness, what are we talking about anyhow when we're talking about that? Delusion, or whatever it is that we're talking about. What are we talking about anyhow? What is that in this world of emptiness? We'll have all kinds of ideas. We'll construct. Maybe delusion seems to us like some kind of beast, some kind of thing we can't surmount. So again, we're thinking about it in those terms. I gotta get over this. I got to get rid of it. But look what the next line is. In this world of emptiness. So what do we have there to begin with? The stuff that we take to be so solid. But may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. So again, this is pointing to what Steve was pointing out. May we exist in muddy water. I think sometimes people think the practice is to clarify the water, to get rid of the muddy water, right? To make it clean. But that's not it at all. It says, may we exist in muddy water. With purity like a lotus. And the lotus grows from muddy water. And we all know lotuses, they're not muddy. They grow in muddy water, and yet they're spotless. You know? May we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. I painted that on a wall in Longfellow neighborhood after the George Floyd uprising. So many of those buildings were burned. And some arts organization was just having people write messages on that wall. And I thought it seemed so appropriate. May we exist in muddy water. Here's this muddy water. Watch your own mind. What's showing up right now? That's really what we want to ask ourselves. What's showing up right now? Nothing surpasses the boundless mind. This is reality. Nothing is outside of it. You can't get rid of delusion because it's The boundless mind. Whatever it is that we're calling delusion, that's what it is. It's the boundless mind. Nothing can surpass it. Nothing can be outside of it. And because of that, everything we do is bowing to Buddha. Everything we do. Thus we bow to Buddha. You trip on your way out the door, you're bowing to Buddha. You know? You smile at a child, you're bowing to Buddha. I just saw a great picture the other day. A friend of mine rescues golden retrievers. They're old dogs. She tends to do old dogs. And she brought the golden retriever to see Santa. So she had a picture of this old golden retriever just with this look on its face of, golden retrievers are so sweet, meeting Santa. That's bowing to Buddha. Her taking that picture is bowing to Buddha. But so is us cursing at somebody who cut us off, you know, on the road when we're driving. So is us when we break something. So is us when we, whatever it is, get mad at somebody, realize we're holding hatred in our heart or don't even realize that. Thus we bow to Buddha. So do we bow to Buddha in this half-hearted way that we usually go through the world, or do we bow to Buddha fully bowing to Buddha? And that's a question I would ask. So Steve goes on, he says, ninth century Zen teacher Linji, Rinzai in Japanese, one of the great Zen teachers from China, said this about freedom. There are Zen students who are in chains when they go to a teacher and the teacher adds another chain. The students are delighted, unable to discern one thing from another. This is called a guest looking at a guest. And Steve goes on to say, many of us come to Zen teachers wrapped in the chains of our concepts and ideas, expecting that the teacher will give us more of the same. Though I would say, they are expecting more of the same. They're not thinking it's going to be more chains. You know, they come thinking, okay, he's going to give me some ideas about things that I can do, some understanding of the world that's going to free me. But they come expecting the teacher is going to give us more of the same. This is why we're delighted when we meet a teacher who will hand us something. Thank you very much, we say with heartfelt appreciation. But it's just another thing for us to grasp, and we're used to grasping. We don't easily tolerate Zen teachers who make baffling and seemingly cryptic statements we can't understand. No, it's much more comfortable when they hand us something we can take hold of, sink our teeth into, carry with us, identify with. That's a real tough one right there, that identification. And even the teachers who don't think they're handing you something, the student will just find something to turn into something they can grab hold of, say thank you very much, and then identify with that. But what we identify with and call our own. In delusion, we think that awakening to this moment is just another item to complete and knock off our list of things to do. And so we try to get a better idea of what reality is like. You get that, a better idea of what reality is like, instead of stepping away from intellection altogether. So now we have Linji pointing out that when we go to a teacher, when we come to a practice, when we come to the world, you know, you have to go to Zen. And what you're going to do is you're going to ask it a question you want an answer from, something you can grab hold of. And let's face it, this is not, there's nothing wrong with this, right? This is very natural. I have literally asked myself, I think I've even said it aloud because I'm a verbal person, when my life was in one of the many spots that I was incredibly unhappy with, why isn't there a user's manual for this? I don't know what I'm supposed to do right now. I have no idea what I'm supposed to do. It'd be nice to have those answers, we think. But as I pointed out, if you actually had a user's manual that could address all the things that are going to happen in your life, good luck finding that answer, especially when you need it, because that user's manual is going to be, I think of that Borges image of a book where the pages are made out of sand. You know what I mean? It's just going to be endless. So how would you ever find a thing anyhow? So you probably don't want it, but you think you want it. We do want some kind of reassurance, you know, some kind of sense we know what's going on, because it's scary. When we think that intellectually understanding the world is the way to do it, it's scary to us when we don't understand what's going on. And actually, the truth is, we don't understand what's going on. A lot. You know, my husband accidentally broke a mug the other day and had coffee. It was full of coffee. Just poured himself some coffee. It was just one of those weird things. And we couldn't figure out where all the coffee went. He had a full mug of coffee. And I was like, where? I mean, there's a little splash there, but that was a whole mug of coffee. We may find out. I don't know. But that's the world. We don't know. We think we know what's going on. We don't really know. The light of wisdom shows us the dust, all the ideas we have about what's going on in the world. So with Rinzai then, he's teaching, or Linji, he's pointing to this teaching where Zen students are already enchained, and then they go to another teacher who's more than happy to, out of compassion, give them more chains. I mean, I don't think those teachers are intending to enchain their students. And I have to watch it, you know, as a teacher. This is something I have to be wary of, because I do have great compassion for people who talk to me, especially about this stuff, but about anything. And then there I am wanting to give an answer, to make it okay, you know. And that's just not how it works. It's not how it works. Not this teaching. And really, even in life, if you've ever done that, sometimes people go, leave me alone. Stop being nice. You know, because really that's not how it works. We all have to kind of figure that. That doesn't mean don't help people, for sure. I'm not saying that. But when we think we're I don't know, giving them the answer that's going to help solve things, just at least look at that. Notice when you're doing that. Notice your desire to do that. So, but Zen teachers that are giving the same thing, as Linji points out, they're just burdening their students more. He calls this is guest looking at guest. So this is delusion. That guest, that transient world that takes the transient world for being something other than it is, looking at a guest. So this is confusion looking at confusion. The blind leading the blind, you could say. Steve Hagen in Buddhism Plain and Simple tells a story that I remember, because I had this similar kind of experience when I was a teacher outside of Zen, when I was teaching college students. And I remembered my favorite teachers. I remember Arthur Ballett, who was a theater professor at the University of Minnesota. And Arthur loved dropping little things in your lap that you couldn't grab hold of. Actually, they weren't things you could. They were things you couldn't grab hold of. You know, and he would go, you're going to remember this. You're going to think. He goes, for years, I had a student come, you know, years later. That's what I meant to say. It was for years, because Arthur taught at Todd's aunt, who's the age of my mom, studied with Arthur Ballett, and I studied with Arthur Ballett. So he was at the university for a long time, for years. But what he would say is that years after he would have them in his class, students in college, they go, you know, I still haven't figured that one out. You know, I remember, I still remember one. It's from the play The Duchess of Malfi. And I remember Arthur said, this line characterizes the Jacobean era. Cover her face, mine eyes dazzle, she died young. And that's all Arthur would tell us. And then we were left to sort of work on that one, to figure that out. And he said, yeah, students would come years later and they would ask him, okay, Arthur, what does that mean? I don't understand. Or they'd say, Professor Ballett, because he was that kind of guy. Professor Ballett, what? I don't understand. What does this mean? And he wouldn't say. So Steve talks about this teacher in Buddhism Plain and Simple. He says, a friend of mine, a physician, told me of his days in medical school when he was overwhelmed with information. He said, some teachers could package the information very simply. Here, this is what you need to know. Medical students love those teachers, he said. And that's where my experience as a teacher came in, is I would come in and I would be baffling to my students and they would just get aggravated and then I would feel terrible. And then I'd try to figure out, how can I make it simpler for them? And Steve goes on, he says, but there were other teachers who always offered two or more contradictory perspectives on things. This the students hated. involved more work on our part, my friend said. Who wants to be told that some people think this and some people think that? It was so much easier just to be told what is what. But, he said, as years went by and he became more and more experienced as a doctor, he realized that the compact, nicely packaged views were wrong. The teachers had chopped off all the rough edges that didn't fit into the system. So that learning that the students who had the teachers who gave them kind of both ways or more than two ways, that teacher was allowing the students to really engage in the work that the other students weren't going to start engaging in until much later. And probably after some things had gone awry, when they were like, oh, wait a minute, but I was... In my anatomy class, we were told that this was always going to be like this, and this is, you know, whatever it was. And so now they're bumping up against their ideas, and they're still going to have to learn what it was that the original teacher, who was going to show them each way, was going to show them. But the students wanted it simple. They want, come on, we know this, right? You don't want, you know, if students would ask me about an assignment that they didn't understand, and I started explaining it, I could just watch their eyes glaze over. Because I was trying to get them so they could intellectually understand it, which was important because we were in a class, so intellectual understanding was important. I wanted them to get to understand the kind of theory or my idea behind the assignment so that if they couldn't really understand the way that I wrote it, that they could understand what it was I was trying to get them to do. And instead, their eyes would glaze over. And finally, somebody said, we didn't ask you to explain it to us. We asked you what it was you're telling us to do. You know, and that's... I think very common for us. We want it in a nice little package that we can understand intellectually, that we can swallow. But remember, any idea we have, any belief we have, any conceptualization we have, you're going to run into its limits. It's inevitable that will happen. So the teachers then that are teaching spiritual teachings, that are teachings and teachings that give us that, they give us these ideas about waking up, that waking up is perhaps something we can grab hold of. And I do know, by the way, that it's not, you know, we can always just watch our own mind. When we want a teacher to give us that, just notice that we're doing that. You know, teacher's only human. They may just kind of go, oh, she needs something, you know, and then give them something. Just be aware of your own desire to have that as well. You know, it's not necessarily the teacher's creating that idea in your mind. You already have it, and the teacher is just kind of placating it, maybe in a way they think is innocent and not going to cause any problems. But then waking up turns into something you can do, something that you put on your bucket list, like the guy that I know I've talked about that I met who told me when he found out that I was... At that time, I was practicing Zen. He said, oh, he goes, I sat meditation for all. He goes, I don't have to do it anymore. I had my Kensho experience, so I'm all done with that now. And I went, good for you. I don't even know what to say. But that's not how, you know, enlightenment works. It's not this thing that you're going to be achieving and you get there. And, you know, enlightenment is just this. It's really just this experience we're in right now. And we can be awake to it or not be awake to it. In each moment, we have the opportunity to really see, to realize, to know, in the way Steve was talking about at the beginning of this chapter, what it is that's taking place. So just remember that great story that Norm used to tell in his first Sesshin. He's at a Sesshin. It's your first Sesshin, right? And Norm went to it, and he had a great experience. He was having samadhi, you know, he was just like one-pointed awareness. He was like, this is it. I've only been doing this for a couple months, and look at this. This is terrific. I am going to be the greatest student I'm going to be the next Buddha, I think. I'm so good. I'm going to go tell, and I can't remember if it was Suzuki or Katagiri, but I do think it was Katagiri, but it was in San Francisco at Tassajara, actually. And he went up to Katagiri, and Dokusan, he said, oh, but I have all these great experiences. And he told them all the things were going on. And Katagiri said, oh, don't worry about that. And then he says, how's your posture? How's your breath? How's your mind? Takes us right back to what it is that we're doing here. So teachers that give us something, unfortunately, are just feeding that sense we have already, that delusion we have that we're missing enlightenment. We can have it, we can get it, and we can be really good at it. But no, it's just, how's your breath? How's your posture? How's your mind? Get simplified that clearly in meditation practice, in Sesshin. So Steve goes on, he says, find where I am right now. There we go. Zen, that is meditation, and that is literally the translation of Zen, is meditation, is simply coming back to just this. So what I was just talking about there. Being present, noticing that we babble to ourselves. So that's the word, babble, that we babble to ourselves. That we tell stories to ourselves. That we try to explain everything. Zen will never say anything to you. If it does, it's only because you're making it up. If you tell yourself, oh, that was good meditation, I really got into something deep there. Or it's, my meditation was off, my mind was really disturbed. That's nonsense. It's just pure delusion. Or if you try to justify your meditation practice by saying, my day goes so much better when it begins with meditation. It's all delusion. Steve says, I never once heard my teacher talk like this. And I can honestly say I've never heard my teacher talk like this either. This is just our spinning minds jabbering to themselves. Oh, he had both jabbering and blabbing in here. So we have both of them. That's all it is. So again, you know, we go, it's good meditation. Really good. Like Norm was doing at that session. Or the flip side, which is, man, I'm really off. And you'll hear that. You go, people go, I've been at concern at all, or whatever, curse word. You know, I've been at this for 15 years and I still get lost off in thought. You know, you think by now I would, you don't have to do that. This is what our minds do. Our minds have this tendency to evaluate, especially when we're treating things as things. We evaluate them. Are they good? Are they bad? That's what pops up. So delusion, remember, is not good or bad. It's neither one of these. Meditation, same way, not good or bad. And I know when I started meditation, I remember this. I really wanted to talk about meditation. I really wanted to talk about it. I wanted to talk about when it was good, when I had those deep moments. I wanted to talk about the moments it wasn't good. I wanted to talk about how other people's lives might have been transformed by taking up meditation, and maybe sort of like craning your neck when you drive past a car wreck, I wanted to hear about those people who didn't have their lives transformed, you know. So I wanted to talk about it. And I remember Steve telling me that kind of talk was really just going to impede my practice. And at the time, I didn't understand it because I thought, I'm a grown-up. I came to this pretty late in life, you know. I'm just like, I can handle some conversation about meditation. But now I see what it is that Steve was pointing to. And it really can impede your practice because it's all just caught up in ideas about what practice is. It's all Norm going to Katagiri and telling him how sure he is that he's going to be the next Buddha or whatever it was that he told him. And we can do this with Sesshin as well because it's just our meditation practice. So you come out of a session and go, that was terrible. Oh, why did I do that? Or you come out of a session and you go, wow. I know they've been bad before, but this is good. And again, I talked to Steve about that because they were like going, boom, boom, boom. You know, I'd have a great one, I have a terrible one. It started out terrible. I had a terrible one, then I had a great one. And then my next one, after the great one, I don't know how, but it was worse than the first one. And I was like, you know. And Steve just said, look, you just let that go. At the beginning, it's going to seem like you're going to ping pong. It's going to seem like it's the best thing and the worst thing. And he goes, and after a while, it levels out. And what I really realized he was talking about is, my mind stopped doing that to this practice. You know, it takes a while. It still comes up. You still have those moments where you go, now I was just thinking about a TV ad for the last, whatever dumb thing's going through your mind for the last 10 minutes. What? It comes up. Just notice that that is what it is that's showing up then. But don't get into this evaluating your practice. When we teach meditation instruction here at Dharma Field, one of the three legs of practice is don't judge your practice. And that's both ways. So don't go, I'm just not good at this. How can you be? It's just being here. You can't really be good or bad at it. Just keep noticing. Just keep bringing yourself back to it. And a good one too. Wow, I'm really accomplishing something. Both of those will cause problems. They'll just cause problems. You'll put this practice down because you'll see it as something you can set down. You'll see it differently than what it is. I'm closing up here, so this is the last little section. So again, when we go to a teacher and we want something from the teacher, and then we think the teacher's given us something, or we look at our practice and we look at what our practice is giving us, what is it I'm getting from this practice? Just remember, that is guest looking at a guest. So that's, Steve's going to pick that up again. Linji said, this is called a guest looking at a guest. In other words, we attend not to what we experience directly, but what we make of it. Thus we ignore what in Zen we call the host, the actual experience of this moment. We ignore there is no separation between reality and ourselves. Truth speaks to us directly without words. We're already in and of enlightenment, but we don't see it. Instead, we go on thinking we're something separate and well-defined, something with a name and identity. If we'd only let such thoughts pass through, we'd realize we're already the host within the host, and all issues of bondage and freedom would slip away. So when we get caught up in our thoughts, what we're really doing is we're just not attending to what it is that's really showing up. When we get caught up in our conceptualizations, when those become our sense of what's really taking place is happening anyhow. It's happening anyhow, regardless of what we might think or feel about it. But as Steve points out, if we can realize that we are the host within the host, and now he comes to that phrase, the host within the host, that to me is like, and I was trying to find where this came from, and I don't remember, and I'm sure I'm wording it wrong, and I'm sure it's worded better. But it was a teaching I heard of reality greeting itself, reality meeting itself, which is strange because reality can't do that. It's not two separate things, but that's what this is. That's this host within the host, is to realize that the host, that stillness, is you. That stillness is you. You're not separate from it. It is to realize that. And when you do, Steve says, issues of bondage and freedom slip away. Both of them slip away. Bondage and freedom. They come together. Our usual way of thinking about things. If we think we're bound and we need to be free from it, that's a dualistic way of thinking. The freedom Steve's talking about is not that freedom that's caught up in bondage. Rather, it is just the boundless nature of reality. It is the non-separation of all things. There is nothing that binds us. There's nothing that puts us in a box or that hampers us in any way in our core. So we could probably think about examples in the world where people are bound, imprisoned, or imprisoned in ways other than steel bars or concrete walls. We know that exists, but in our core, in our heart, we cannot be bound. Our core, the essence of being, is boundless. And if nothing binds us, then no liberation. In the way that it's pointed to us in the Heart Sutra. So if you're reading the Heart Sutra, and I know when you first encounter that, that seems like a pretty nutty thing. No. I called those the no-no-no's recently. There's more than just three of them, though. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. But also talks about no bondage, no liberation, right? No ignorance, at one part it says, and also no extinction of it, and so forth, until no old age and death, and also no extinction of them. No suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. But wait a minute. These are the Four Noble Truths. Isn't there suffering? Isn't there a cause of suffering? Doesn't suffering arise from desire or from self? There's no stopping. Wait a minute. Does that mean I have to... No path? It's all gone. In the way we usually think it is. But here we are. Suffering is showing up. Conditions are arising for suffering to show up. We can be released from that. There is a way that we can take this up. And yet, it is in the spirit of no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, that there is freedom. That is realizing the freedom that, as Steve says, we are of. At the freedom that we are in and of. And that's my talk. A little bit gassier than Cindy's talk was yesterday, so Cynthia's talk. Do people have any questions or comments? Mark? Does he still play video games? He wanted to design them. I would guess he still does, actually. Yeah. And I usually don't name him. I can't believe I said his name today. But that's all right.
I just wanted to say that the bird poem reminded me of another frequently studied bird in poetry, the nightingale. And I was reading Coleridge's Nightingale, probably the lesser famous one, as opposed to Keats. And in the Coleridge Ode to a Nightingale, he realizes, he acknowledges something that a few of the romantic poets do, which is that the nightingale is just a bird, and that its song actually doesn't mean anything, even though we decided it connotes like melancholy and sorrow and this sort of thing. But he acknowledges that it's a fallacy, but because it's a fallacy, he can use it in his poetry. But something I wanted to share is that there is something always like very tragic for me and Sashin, because I realize that just like Coleridge realizes that the bird's song is not for him, or it doesn't mean exactly what he thinks it does. In Sashin, I realize, I think we all do, that the life that I was living before I sat down didn't mean what I thought it did. And that's a hard thing to sit with, you know, over the hours that we're here. And freedom does flow out of that eventually, but it is still very painful at first, waking up to that. And I hope that's not too reckless of a thing to say, because I don't mean to pass judgment on it one way or another. But, I appreciate your talk.
Thank you, Peter. And that's something that's very important to acknowledge, and what you were just pointing out, that feeling we have of having lost something that we can have when we encounter these teachings, that in a way they seem like they're taking something from us. And, you know, what we can do is be present with that pain. In that pain, we can see what it is that we're doing. And of course, it has a sharpness, as you were pointing out, Peter, which is, what did we have? What Zen is really helping us to see is that what we thought we had, we never really had. But as we're first encountering it, it feels like you're taking something away from us, you know. And that can be very hard. And so we don't want to dismiss that at all. You know, be with that. Realize that. Sit with that. That is how reality is showing up right now, is in that pang. But if we can really see that Zen's not taking anything away from us, that it's actually, as you said, you say liberation will blow through that, you know, but it actually is liberation. And liberation can hurt. It certainly can hurt. So I appreciate your sharing that, Peter. Thank you. And what were we going to say, Cynthia?
Well, I just want to thank Peter for articulating it so nicely. The way that I talked about that when I started practicing Zazen ruined my life. Exactly. For the reason that you stated. Yeah. Yeah. But also in time, come to realize I just lost this giant fantasy. Painful. It's still a loss. No doubt about it. It's still a loss. But you see the emptiness of it. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay, thanks.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.